Spirit Radio Podcasts.
There has been so much bad news coming out of Syria over the last few years, but rare pieces of good news have been the international aid that has made it possible for displaced Christian families to return to their town and homes through housing reconstruction projects. Well, John Pontifex from the Aid to the Church in Need has been to Syria to see how these projects are progressing. And on the line now to tell us more, we have John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need, at the charity that has been crucial in sustaining these families and bringing about this rebuilding work. You're very welcome to the show, John. First of all, John, could you tell us where you went during your recent trip to Syria?
Well, we set off from the centre of the city of Damascus, and from there made our way to Maloula and on to the Homs, and also to the Valley of the Christians, and finally wound up in Tartus on the Mediterranean coast.
Wonderful. The local people that you met with have faced such hardships over recent years. Could you possibly give us some background as to what happened to them in the areas you were in and to their homes?
Well, I have been to Syria over the last 4 years, each year going back to see the situation, and the scale of the devastation is beyond description. It seems that almost every house you pass by has either been completely destroyed or is largely uninhabitable. And the result of this is that the massive work of reconstruction lies ahead, and they really have only just started. But for some families, they are absolutely determined to make their way back against all odds. Some indeed are making that journey back. Some of them we saw living in the bombed out remains of their homes. I remember looking up at a very shelled building, and there you could see some washing hanging out in the bombed out upstairs room. And indeed there were people sat there waving at us as they sat on plastic chairs. So this is a token of the extent to which people really want to return and start again. But of course many of them still want out. So there's very much a divided nation in terms of those wanting to stay and those wanting to leave.
Mm-hmm. At the height of the conflict in 2014, there were less than 100 Christians remaining in the old city in Homs, targeted attacks by Islamist extremists that forced nearly 250,000 to leave. So it's large figures we're working with here. You were talking a bit about people on top floors of shelled buildings with their washing out. Could you tell us a bit more about the state of other houses that were there due to conflict?
Well, the devastation we've seen in different parts of Homs particularly varies from place to place. In some areas we've seen houses that were only minor damage, but others close to the front line of the conflict between the rebels and the government-held areas were completely flattened. And indeed, it is to one of these areas that we went to see one particular family who indeed have made it back and are now living in their rebuilt home. And the grandmother of the family there, age 94, there she was, Fausia, very, very happy to meet the representatives of the organization which had enabled her to make her way back home. And we could see the repainted walls, the reconstructed doors and windows, and a semblance of normality in their environment had at last become apparent. But there's just so much work still needing to be done.
It's a promising start, anyway. John, tell us about the rebuilding scheme the Aid to the Church in Need are involved with.
Well, we were there to see the signing of a document between Aid to the Church in Need on the one hand and the various bishops. Of course, there are different rites of bishops, of churches. You've got Greek Catholic Melkites, you've got Maronites, and you've got the Chaldeans and various others. But all of them were signatories of this document, which would see the rebuilding in the first phase of 300 homes. That would take place over the course of the next year or so, and would prepare the way for a much wider plan of rebuilding, involving up to 1,000 homes across the city, but mostly in the old city, and there we would see the rebuilding of homes across these different denominations, be they Greek Catholic or Greek Orthodox or Maronite or whatever, because the sense is that if we don't do something now, the future of that particular part of Syria will be completely lost, and the families are looking for a quick sign to show that indeed this charity aid to the Church Need is willing to make good their determination to restart their lives back in the city where they've lived for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. So action is required fairly urgently. Tell us who you met with when you were over there, and what this project means to the local community, the local people.
Well, in the morning of our middle day in Homs, we met the bishops, the Syriac Orthodox Bishop Salvanos, for example, and the Greek Melkite Archbishop Arbash on the other, and the Greek Orthodox Archbishop and various others, who explained to us how they believed very strongly that this community, whose Christian presence dates back to 50 AD, which is when the first church in Homs was alleged to have been built, this community deserves to belong to the land. They deserve to rebuild their lives, and it's part of their identity to belong to Homs. They made that very, very clear, and it was a message that was also reflected in the meetings we had with several families in different parts of the old city who said much the same. The huge concern for them is not so much security in that part of Syria, it's more to do with the financial problems. Many of them have absolutely no money at all. There's no state security if you're a non-government employee. And as a result, people who haven't got jobs, which is by far the most people, are really, really struggling. And yet, they said again and again, our dearest wish is to go back. This is where we belong. This is where we have been for so many years. And this is where all our friends have been. And provided that the situation is secure, and there's good reason to believe it now is, let's make good that determination to go back. Let's rebuild our homes, let's rebuild our lives, and let's start afresh. And we were flabbergasted by their courage, not felt by everybody, mind you, but certainly felt by those we met there.
And what other kinds of support, finally, will these communities need going forward?
Well, there are two types of community. One is the one we've just touched on. The families have gone back. They need support for the rebuilding of their homes, which is still going on, of course. And in the meantime, they will need emergency support, food, medicine, shelter, and so on. But in the meantime, Aid to the Church in Need is committed to providing ongoing emergency aid for those internally displaced families. Millions of them are away from their homes, living mostly in a room of a home that belongs to a Christian, 8 or 10 or perhaps more to a room. And these families are absolutely dependent on Aid to the Church Need and others to provide basic food, basic medicine, basic shelter, and indeed scholarships, enabling the education system to continue. And Aid to the Church Need is very proud to commit to supporting students so that they can complete their studies. And this process means that 80% of our aid for Syria, 750 projects or so over the course of the past 8 years, is about emergency aid. And we've got a situation in which many of the big international organizations have, for their own reasons, decided not to continue supporting Syria in this way. But this means that the pressure on the likes of Aid to the Church and Need to continue that support is very, very apparent. And so we're hoping very much to continue that help. And the thanks and praise that our benefactors received while we were there was very touching to hear.
John Pontifex, Head of Press and Information at Aid to the Church in Need UK. Thank you so much for joining us today, John. And you can find out more about that at acnireland.org, also acnuk.org as well. Well, the news comes and goes so fast that often we might miss out on what actually has happened. So it's wonderful this morning to have in the studio Padraig Maher from the Spirit Radio news team to look at some really interesting and perhaps unusual stories from the past week. Padraig, you're very welcome to the programme. How are you doing?
Thank you very much.
And first of all, Padraig, we've been covering the government plans for relationships and sexuality education over the last few weeks, and also a consultation deadline ended on Friday the 15th of February. What have you noticed in the news since then?
So I noticed immediately the very following day, on the Saturday, in the Times Ireland edition, I noticed no fewer than three stories dealing with the question related to sexuality, and three stories specifically dealing with sexual dangers to children and teenagers. And just to give you a flavour of the headlines, one said teenagers' sex videos shared by paedophiles, and other sex predators targeting children in explicit group chats on Twitter. And then a third one, it was alert children aged 2 to online risks, charity urges. Another example then from yesterday, a headline on Sky News said, Ireland, outdated sex education blamed for record HIV diagnoses. So I couldn't help but noticing that there was a common theme in these stories, and that it occurred soon after the RSD consultation had come to an end. So it looked to me like here's a theme that might be used in the coming weeks and months to justify the new RSC program. An argument that says it's not about whether parents approve of the program itself, mm-hmm. but it's about mitigating harm that could potentially be done to children and teenagers otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Could you remind us what the Department of Education is proposing for the new RSC curriculum and how that ties in with legislation?
So the RSC, what is being proposed is that it be updated to take into account changes in Irish society and legislation in the last 20 years. Now, the three most important changes in legislation refer to the legalisation of same-sex marriage, the possibility and the legalisation of changing sex, and also then of the recent abortion legislation. Now, a way of understanding what is going on here is that if these three acts, these three recent pieces of legislation legalized each of these things, then what the RSE seeks to do then is to normalize them.
And what do you mean when you say that education normalises certain practices and behaviours?
Well, it's very funny. In the Irish Times last Saturday, there was an article on the idea of polyamory. So this is where somebody might have multiple partners at the same time as opposed to monogamy. And in that very article, it talked about normalising, and it gave a definition of it. It said, the true signifier that something has been accepted into mainstream culture is indifference. That's the luxury of having no particular feelings. That indicates that a phenomenon's normality. So the idea here is that it's not about getting people to positively approve of LGBT relationships or people wanting to change their sex or approving of abortion or the use of pornography, but it's about getting people to the point where they no longer see it as different. That instead it'll become as ordinary and everyday as sliced pan or packets of crisps.
Well, watch this space. We'll be covering more of this with yourself, Padraig, very soon. Thank you. And your next story relates to new guidelines for Irish doctors. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, so these concern the code of ethics that governs the practice of medicine in Ireland. And these, of course, are the guidelines that every single doctor has to abide by. And since abortion was legalised in the country, the Medical Council have been updating their guidelines to take account of this and to decide how they are to respond to it.
Okay.
So prior to Christmas, just before the Abortion Act came into being, one thing they did was to simply delete the paragraphs that they had dealing with abortion. But in the meantime, they've been looking at the code as a whole to see what other things they might need to tweak in order to take account of abortion being legalized.
Okay, and what struck you most about said revised wording?
So the one that really jumped out at me was one paragraph. There's a line in the existing code that says, you must not take part in the deliberate killing of a patient. So that now, in the revised one, it's proposed, it will say, you must not take part in the unlawful killing of a patient. So that's a massive, massive difference there from the not take part in the deliberate killing to not take part in the unlawful killing. So it makes it clear that now there are some situations where it will be ethical medically to deliberately kill a patient. The other thing that struck me about it was that it's putting it in such bald and blatant terms, you know. I mean, in this age when we're so used to political spin, we're so used to euphemisms, to politically correct terminology, we rarely hear things put as starkly as that.
Yeah, and how will that affect the medical profession, in your opinion?
Well, it's bound to have an effect on how doctors understand their work and understand what they're doing. There is, and it's ironic, elsewhere in the code there is a specific paragraph that said that medical care must not be used as a tool of the state, and that likewise a doctor must give appropriate treatment without political pressure. So I think the question has to be asked whether in this situation the profession are adopting principles specifically in a way that is subservient to legislation and subservient to political pressure.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to your final story, perhaps slightly different, a little lighter. Could you talk to us about the actor Jussie Smollett and why he's now in trouble with the police?
Oh, this is just an absolutely crazy story, and it's one of those ones where, you know, if it were a TV series, you would say it's unbelievable, you know. Yeah. So Jussie Smollett is an actor in on a Fox program called Empire, very well known. He's also an excellent singer. Happens to be a black man and gay as well. And so he reported that on January 29th, while he was in Chicago at 2 o'clock in the morning, going out to get a Subway sandwich, he was viciously attacked by two individuals. So he said these were two white men who recognized him on the street. They then hurled racist and homophobic slurs at him, and then they physically attacked him as well. He said that they were wearing ski masks, but he could see they were white, and they were also wearing red baseball caps. And then they also proceeded to put a noose around his neck and even pour bleach on him. So, I mean, it really just sounds, it was absolutely horrific, what was reported. It made headline news, not only in America, but it also seeped into the newspapers and the RTE news here. And it was commented on far and wide, with some leading politicians in America referring to it as a modern day lynching.
Wow, my goodness. And why do you think Jussie Smollett did this? And
So in the days that followed, some people expressed skepticism about the details of the story, because it just seems so extreme as to beggar belief. There was also then some details that didn't add up. Mm-hmm. Like on the night in question, Chicago, if you've ever been there, is an incredibly cold city in the winter. On this particular night, they were also suffering what was called a polar vortex.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, this was the night he decided to go out at 2 o'clock in the morning to get a sandwich from Subway.
Despite the polar vortex, yes.
Yeah. And then the local television stations kept up with the story and to investigate and try to get further details on it. And they revealed then things like he refused to hand over his phone to the police, even though he said he was on a call for the duration of the attack. And there were some other little things that didn't add up. either. So he responded to these doubts then by going on national television and giving an interview on Good Morning America, where he said things like, who would ever make up something like this? And he portrayed himself as a victim, and he wept on camera at the idea that he might not get justice out of this because they might not catch the perpetrators. So it was an incredible spectacle. So then a few days after that, he was then arrested by the Chicago police on the charge that he had staged the entire thing.
Well, yeah. And gosh, and so what lessons do you think we could learn from Jesse Smollett and his story, his rhetoric?
Oh, well, I mean, I think the first lesson is don't be Jesse Smollett. If you're thinking of staging a hoax attack in order to raise your profile, and as the Chicago PD police said, in order to then get a raise in his salary, that's probably not the way to go about it.
There are other ways.
Yeah, it was also crazy. Like there was some details, like the two guys that he hired to do it were two bodybuilding Nigerian brothers. Things like he had phone contact with them before the attack and again afterwards, and this is something he tried to hide from the police. He paid the guys $3,500. He paid them by check,
which they could obviously track down fairly quickly.
And I've noticed as well that sometimes when it comes to a story like this, that when there'll always be a certain cohort of people that will believe the initial allegation, those who don't. But it looks to me like across the board at this stage, people, the vast majority of people have lost, who stood up for Jesse Smollett originally, they've lost trust in him.
Yeah.
And there's a real disgust amongst people who originally were fighting his corner. But I suppose in the global view of looking at things, there's something to be said there for stories that arise that confirm a certain political narrative. They're the stories that we should be particularly cautious about.
Yes, indeed. Well, that's been a very interesting roundup and analysis of some of the stories in the news in the last week. Porrick Maher from the Spirit Radio news team, thank you so much for talking to us this morning, Porrick. Well, if you've just been listening in, you'll hear it's not Wendy, it's Elspeth Hansen in for Wendy today. She's having a well-earned rest, and I'm delighted to be here. And next up, being an on-the-spot reporter in foreign lands and in conflict zones around the world, it sounds very exciting, but I'm sure it's not for everyone. Well, our next guest works as what he calls a media missionary, and this work has taken him to some of the world's lesser-known hotspots, including the ongoing conflict in East Ukraine. Well, on the line now to talk to us and to tell us more, we have Peter Wooding from Global News Alliance. You're very welcome to the program, Peter.
Thank you, Elspeth. Great to be on your station.
Oh, thanks so much. Lovely to have you with us. Now, first of all, we'd love to hear more about you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, so I guess my family background is both missionary work and journalism. My grandparents, who grew up in Liverpool, went to Nigeria to be missionaries in the late 1930s. And then I grew up in London and then California as the son of a tabloid journalist. My father was a journalist in Fleet Street in the 1970s. So I think I inherited both that passion for media and missions work, which is why I call myself a media missionary. And I did missionary work myself, which actually took me to a group called Youth for the Mission in the UK, and I actually did a leadership course in Drumcondra in Dublin.
Wow.
A long time ago, 1991, with Rob Clark from Spirit Radio.
So, very good.
And then I went into journalism, broadcast journalism, in the late 1990s to work as a news editor for a Christian radio station called UCB. I was there until 10 years ago, and since then I've been a freelance journalist, as you say, traveling all around the world.
So interesting. We're big fans of UCB as well. And now, what is Global News Alliance, and what sort of stories do you seek to cover?
So Global News Alliance is primarily a video news service for broadcasters, radio and television, print, online, but telling what we call the God stories, the stories of what God is doing around the world, trying to tell inspirational, inspiring stories in the midst of, you know, difficult circumstances, and telling some of the stories of some of the unsung heroes that you don't normally hear about in the news.
Mm-hmm. And a little birdie tells me that you've reported from countries such as India, Gambia, Israel, Russia, Mozambique, Dubai. You've been everywhere by the sounds of it. South Korea too. And you were recently in Ukraine. What's the situation there like there at the moment?
It's very difficult because it's been about 5 years now since the Maidan Revolution took place in Kiev, which then spiraled into this conflict with Russia. And while we hear very little about it in the media, this conflict is still going on, mostly in East Ukraine, where I went to just a few weeks ago. And while the fighting isn't as intense, it's still going on. And so we almost call it the silent war because we don't hear about it. But what's wonderful for me is in the midst of such turmoil and devastation, when you go there, it's like a ghost town. Some of these border villages where families have had to just flee for their lives, but those that can't have had to stay. But in the midst of that, I got to report on some amazing, what we call unsung heroes of the faith. Great. When I was there recently. Very inspiring indeed.
Would you actually, on that subject, would you be able to tell us about some of the people that you would see as those unsung heroes amidst the conflict?
Yeah, it's always amazing when you meet these people. They're so modest, you would have no idea of their story until you start to interview them. And one of the most remarkable ones was a UNHCR volunteer paramedic who wanted to, he's actually a vet by profession, but wanted to help right in the height of the conflict, drive ambulances right into the conflict zone, rescue families, rescue the injured, and get them to hospital. Mm-hmm. But on one of these visits, he got stopped by the Russian separatists, and they punished him. They found a Bible in his ambulance. They accused him of being an American spy, said they were going to kill him, and put him in a prison cell. But he said it was like the Book of Acts in the Bible, where Paul somehow was miraculously released from his prison cell. Somehow, they escaped after just 3 days. And managed to carry on doing his work and still risked his life to do this. So that was one incredible story. The other was a pastor called Sergei Kuzmenko, who had to flee his home and his church in Donetsk, which came under siege by the Russian separatists when the war started. But he goes back to the war zone every few weeks, driving a van, taking aid to these families, to the soldiers, and just a very inspiring person. So it's just such a privilege to report on people like that.
It's really bringing the news to us, I suppose, of these individual stories of goodness, of interrogation, and also it's just wonderful to hear of these acts of service that people are doing amidst the silent war, as you described it. You've also been to Nigeria, Kosovo, and the Philippines. What stories have you covered there?
So Nigeria was very special for me. It was my first time going in November 2017, having known all the stories of my grandparents being missionaries there. I was in Lagos to report on the final preaching festival of a German preacher who's like the Billy Graham of Germany. He's called Reinhard Bonnke. Mm-hmm. He'd been preaching in Africa for 50 years, and it was his last ever time preaching there, and it was incredible. On the last night, there was a crowd of 750,000 people there, so that was pretty special. When I went to Kosovo, that was with a charity called Mercy Projects that had been helping people that had suffered during the conflict many years ago, and continue to support projects to build homes for widows, which is incredible to see work being done on homes for these widows that have lost everything and having their lives restored. And also very special to meet a pastor who I interviewed who, during the conflict, just had such hatred towards the Serbians because of the war, but when he became a Christian was able to forgive them, and he started the first church in his village in 500 years. So that was Kosovo. And then with the Philippines, That was with a charity I used to do work for called Samaritan's Purse. If people have heard of Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham, that's his charity. And I used to go in right into these disaster zones. And that was just after the typhoon that took place there. And it was like being on a film set. It didn't seem real to see the devastation of what that typhoon caused. And yet in the midst of that, reporting on this incredible humanitarian work, helping to restore so many lost lives there.
It's inspiring to hear all of this, and so wonderful and that you've been able to go to these places and see it firsthand and report it. Do you ever feel that the work you're doing is dangerous?
Probably, yes. I always pray before I go on these trips whether it's right for me to go. But I think when I'm there, the journalist in me kicks in. I remember one of my last trips into a disaster zone was Nepal. And we were on top of this hill where it had been right at the epicenter of the earthquake. And I got out of the vehicle to get all this footage of all the aid vehicles driving past. And but you have to be wise. But there are times where you think, what am I doing here? You feel on edge. But you also just pray that you're in the right place at the right time.
Absolutely. I suppose I want to ask, what do you hope that your inspiring work will achieve?
Well, really, to tell these unheard-of stories that people will see that there is some great work going on around the world, and that we can report with a fake news-free zone, I guess I'd call it, where people can get to the real facts of what is happening in very difficult circumstances, so that people get the truth, but they get inspiration at the same time.
And speaking of people finding out about this, where can people catch up on with the stories of Global News Alliance?
So very simple, you go to gna.news, and we have several great stories up there at the moment. And then if people want to get a subscription, then they can go on the website and subscribe.
So you can subscribe to gna.news. Well, it's been fascinating to hear about your story, Peter. Thank you so much for joining us from Global News Alliance. Peter Wooding, thank you very much for talking to us this morning. And we look forward to hearing more from you very soon.
Thank you.
Well, we know that our world is in the midst of a massive migration and refugee crisis. However, often we don't tend to know a lot about the people who find their way to our shores seeking refuge. Well, last year, the Irish government pledged to resettle 600 refugees. And our next guest is on the line now to talk to us about one of the ways in which this is happening. It's a pilot project called Home From Home Dublin 6. And part of the project is for individuals in their local community to come together and support refugees living in their area. And on the line now to tell us more, we have Ashley Prodgers, the Salvation Army officer of the Salvation Army in South Dublin. You're very welcome to the show, Ashley.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lovely to have you with us. Now, first of all, Ashley, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Well, I'm a Salvation Army officer. That means I'm a minister within the Salvation Army, which is a church and a charity. But I run with my wife a community church in the Rathmines area. And we're responsible for the congregation there and all the community projects and community groups that we run. We're very actively involved with the other churches in our area. We're part of the Rathgar and Terenure Fellowship, and we have quite a wide range of different denominations in that group. And we've decided to come together and join forces on this refugee community sponsorship scheme, Home From Home Dublin 6.
Great. I'm really excited to hear more about Home From Home Dublin 6, this project. How did the idea come about?
Well, community sponsorship is not a new thing. It's been happening successfully in Canada and more recently in the UK. And it's basically what it is people in communities coming together, pooling their resources and their skills and talents to provide and prepare a welcome, an accommodation and support to refugee families trying to rebuild their lives. We actually have colleagues and friends in the Salvation Army in the UK who've been doing this over the last couple of years. They're like 2 years down the line in welcoming families to their communities, and they found it a very fulfilling ministry, and part of the tagline on our communications flyer is that it takes a community to resettle a family, but it also takes a family to make a community. And I think this project is a way of bringing people together and strengthening our community as well.
Yeah, I love what you said, that it takes a community to resettle a family to strengthen a community. Wonderful. Such great and important work. Now, how does it operate? How does it work? And how can local communities get involved to support your initiative?
Well, our project is a local one, and it's a kind of pilot scheme. The Irish Red Cross have been tasked with coordinating community sponsorship in Ireland. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, it's the trial pilot stage, but they are going to be launching the program nationally on the 6th of March. So very soon, communities all across Ireland will be able to apply to Red Cross to do this. But essentially, what we're doing is we have to work together as a community to source and provide and find accommodation for a family of refugees. We have to do a bit of fundraising, especially for the initial cost of making sure that they have everything they need when they first arrive to Ireland. And we also need to just make sure that they have the support and the network in place that can just help them as they start their new life in Ireland. Mm-hmm. The refugees that would be coming to Ireland, they've already been granted refugee status. They're most likely to be coming from refugee camps in Lebanon. They probably originated from Syria or Iraq. They would have faced unimaginable trauma. Mm-hmm. And we just want to provide them with a safe haven in our local community. We believe that our community in Dublin 6, anyway, we have the means and the resources and the will to do this. So it's just a way of practically providing support. Sometimes we hear the stories on the news, we see them on the news, and we just think, what on earth can we do? And this is a wonderful way for everybody to play their part. So many ways in which people locally can support.
It's real food for thought. I agree. You can often, with something that is so important, and there are so many needs to be met, one could feel helpless in that situation. I suppose, I don't know if you, I mean, we all have different skills. You could be a language teacher or just a chatty person who could grab a coffee.
Exactly, yeah.
Or, you know, more medical skills, you know, dentist, doctor, or therapist. You could donate maybe some, some items to furnish a home for them, or offer your time and skills as a worker or in sewing or...
Exactly.
There's so many practical things we can all do, I'm sure, and muster up and chip in, you know. It's really definitely encouragement for us. There are things we can do. And you're encouraging local communities to get involved with supporting this project.
I explained earlier that we're part of a really strong partnership of different churches, including Methodist Church, Roman Catholic Church, the Quakers. We even have... We have a representative from the Jewish community, Presbyterian Church. It's great to work together, but we want as many local community groups to be involved. The more, the better, because we're stronger together. But I mean, we're doing this in Dublin 6 area. But I'd encourage anyone wherever you are in Ireland to think about: is this something that you in your community, maybe your church, could explore doing as well? I think there's a great deal of public support and will to help in something like this, and the opportunity is there. I mean, we're having a meeting on Monday evening at St. Patrick's Hall, Church of the Three Patrons in Rathgar. That's at 7:30 p.m. And that meeting is coming Monday, 4th of March, and it'll be a great opportunity for people locally to find out more about the scheme. We've got a guest speaker from Irish Red Cross, Eve Leonard. Mm-hmm. We also have the Salvation Army's Refugee Response Coordinator from the UK, who has actually first-hand experience of community sponsorship. We'll be hearing from him, Nick Koch. So it'll be a great opportunity for anyone to come and hear more about the scheme. And even if you're not local to Dublin 6, come along and maybe you can feedback to your own community. Your community could start a similar project.
Great. Ahead of the Irish Red Cross launch at this, of the scheme nationally on the 6th of March. So just details again. So in Dublin 6, the public community meeting is on Monday, March the 4th. Next Monday, it's flying in, isn't it? At 7.30 at St. Patrick's Hall, Three Patrons Church.
Rathgar Road, yeah. Okay. And I just want to stress there's nothing too small or big that you can offer, you know, even if you have a good local knowledge of the bus routes, you know, in your area, you can get involved and you can, you know, pledge to show people arriving in Ireland how to get around, you know, there's nothing too small. And we will be inviting people on Monday evening to reflect and consider about what are the things that they could offer to pledge to this project. If you want to find out more, you can email homefromhomed6@gmail.com. That's homefromhomed6@gmail.com.
That's so helpful. homefromhomed6@gmail.com. And also, just to reiterate the meeting, if you're local to Dublin 6, or even if you're not, there are buses, go along to the public community meeting on Monday, March the 4th, 7.30 kickoff at St. Patrick's Hall in Three Patrons Church to find out more ahead of the scheme nationally launching on the 6th of March. And is the initiative running elsewhere in Ireland? Just a final question, or is it just...
Well, it is, yeah, and in fact, there's a group in Wicklow, a church group that have done this already, and they did this independently. You know, I don't think they did this without the Red Cross involved, but they managed to do this themselves. And you know, that is possible to do, but it's just fantastic that we are going to have a nationally coordinated scheme that anyone, any community can apply to and get that support from the Red Cross and the government who are supporting this and also underwriting the scheme. So there's going to be plenty of opportunities for communities to do a similar thing in the near future.
So exciting, isn't it? Right, well, Ashley Prodges, the Salvation Army officer and church minister of the Salvation Army in South Dublin. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning. It's absolutely fascinating. And people can find out more information. You can email homefromhome6@gmail.com.
Homefromhomed6@gmail.com. Homefromhomed6.
Thank you for the correction. Homefromhomed6@gmail.com. Very clear. Thank you so much, Ashley, for talking to us. And
thank you very much.
Look forward to following it with great interest.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.